I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Lynn Novick first worked for documentarian Ken Burns back in 1989. Since then, she's worked with him as collaborator on 8 films. Today, we'll ask her what goes into crafting those expansive projects, and we'll find out what lessons she learned about the Vietnam War in a new project about that conflict. Then, sex and music have always gone hand in hand. Maybe that's why Methodists in the 1800s argued over how much their bodies should move when playing church songs. NPR music critic Ann Powers talks about the link between love, gender, race, and American pop music. Stay tuned later for your weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Lynn Novick first crossed paths with Ken Burns' work in 1989 as associate producer for post-production on his landmark series, The Civil War. Novick would go on to become a principal collaborator with the documentarian on 8 films, including Prohibition, Baseball, and Jazz. Along the way, Lynn has been recognized with an Emmy and a Peabody Award. Her most recent work with Burns, The Vietnam War, premieres Sunday, September 17th on PBS. Lynn Novick and Ken Burns will be in Kansas City on Friday, September 8th, as guests of honor at an event hosted by public television station KCPT. But this morning, she joins us by telephone from Telluride, Colorado. Lynn, welcome to Up to Date.
Oh, thank you for having me. Good morning.
You know, it takes years to make one of these historical documentaries, and the amount of research must be absolutely tremendous. How do you sort it all out and decide what goes into a film and then what finally doesn't?
Well, that is sort of the nub of the problem for us, is that we start out at the beginning deciding we're going to make a film about the Vietnam War, not really knowing for sure what we're going to discover and keeping a very open process at the beginning to just understand the subject, talk to as many people as we can, figure out who the experts are. And in the case of this particular story, be open to as many points of view and experiences as possible, American and Vietnamese. And that means we set our net just extremely wide and bring in an enormous amount of material. And then it's really a collaborative process with Ken Burns and myself as the directors, and Jeff Ward, our writer, Sarah Botson, our producer, and our team of editors, to kind of distill, hone, boil down, extract the sort of inner narrative from this wealth of material. And that's why the project took 10 years.
You know, you mentioned that you were bringing in all these voices, and typically these documentaries that you guys do have a star. And I'm wondering, I'm told you have some folks from around the Kansas City area, Missouri and Kansas, who will be part of this.
Yes, we do. And, you know, sometimes in some of the films that we've made, some of the films Ken has made, one or two people really rise, such as Shelby Foote in the Civil War series and
right.
Buck O'Neill, who's from Kansas City, in our baseball series. In this film, it's hard to say there's not just one person, because we actually interviewed 100 people in America and in Vietnam. There are 79 in the film.
Mm.
That said, there are a handful of individuals that appear in multiple episodes, and whose stories are so powerful and so indelible and so complex that they really do rise above or sort of stick with viewers. And we've seen that happen again and again. And one of the people who's, I think, most going to be remembered most from his participation in this film is a man named John Musgrave, who is from Baldwin City, Kansas.
Hmm.
And he gave us a remarkable interview in 2011, and it has been one of the treasured parts of this experience for us, is getting to know John and his family and letting them trust us with his story.
You know, you co-directed and co-produced this documentary, The Vietnam War. This is the most modern history I think you've done. How different was it to have so many participants still living and able to give witness to what they experienced?
Yeah, it is a different kind of challenge than going through the diaries and letters and trying to breathe life into words on a page and old photographs. Here we had living witnesses for whom the experiences they were describing were, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, but not 100 years ago, obviously. And because of the nature of this particular conflict and this experience in their lives, it was for many people extremely traumatic and painful, sometimes devastating, also profound and sometimes life-affirming. So I guess what I'm saying is that people were sharing with us some of the most indelible and important experiences of their lives, and that once they started talking, it didn't seem that far away. Hmm. And that was exciting and terrifying and profound for all of us on the filmmaking side, because people trusted us with these treasures, things that matter most to them, and we felt honor-bound to try to make a film that would do justice to the testimony that we were so generously given.
Lynn Novick, who co-directed and co-produced the upcoming PBS series The Vietnam War, is my guest. You filmed in Vietnam, and how much?
Yes, I was lucky enough to make many trips to Vietnam over the course of the project. We made three different trips with cameras, and I just came back last week from a final trip, bringing the film back to share with the people who were in it. And what we found over and over again was extraordinary generosity there as well as here, just like people are people, and they want to tell their stories. And in Vietnam, the war is both a great, triumphant sort of national origin story of how they created their country. And on the other hand, it's an enormous tragedy and on an epic scale that's hard for Americans to really appreciate because of how many Vietnamese were killed in the course of the war. And it was also a civil war as well as a war, what they would call the national liberation. And so it's unfinished business there. There's a lot of reckoning and reconciling still to do. And I think for that reason, people were open to telling their stories to us, maybe because we came from outside the country, and it's sometimes easier to tell your story to someone from the outside than to the people closest to you. And we heard again and again from veterans and civilians there that in Vietnam, they don't talk much about the war in a personal way, in a human way. It's sort of an abstraction. And there was a tremendous interest and openness to kind of peeling back the curtain and taking a look inside.
Who did you interview there, Lynn, and how were you able to find them?
We went through a very similar process to what we do here. The difference is that we had a wonderful Vietnamese producer, Ho Dang Hoa, who's a veteran himself and who helped us identify people and explain to them what we were looking for, which was really the human story of the war and what the war meant for them and their families. And we just started sort of trial and error, word of mouth, talking to people. Some of the people we talked to had written about their experiences, so that was helpful as a good way to get started. We had the privilege of interviewing a man named Bao Nien, who wrote a novel about the experiences of ordinary soldiers in the war that was published in the early 1990s. That's a seminal work in Vietnam about the war, and has sort of been paired with Tim O'Brien's novel, The Things They Carried, as a sense of just what the war was really like. And he doesn't often give interviews. He's sort of almost considered to be a recluse, but he wanted to be part of the project. And he gave us a remarkable testimony of just what the war was like, how wrenching it was, how unsettled it is, how difficult it is to talk about, some of the same themes that we felt here. We also talked to women who were frontline soldiers there because they had a total war. So women carried weapons and, you know, did some of the killing and some of the dying. Women worked on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was an epic undertaking, trying to keep those roads open under the bombing, constant bombing. 20,000 Vietnamese died on the Ho Chi Minh Trail just trying to keep it open. And that's one of their major accomplishments, but also tragedies of the war. So, you know, what we found was that the Vietnamese people that we spoke with were open to trying to explain to themselves, to their families, and to Americans the real nature of the war, the horrific nature of it, the suffering, the misery, and also the resilience and the sort of determination, all those things.
You know, you said about this war, and I'm quoting here, in order to move on as a country at all, we have to really understand what happened. And I'm wondering, after making this film, do you think we do understand what happened over there?
Well, I hope that when people see our film, they'll get a better sense of that. Certainly speaking for Ken and me and for our team, we went into this thinking that we knew quite a bit about it. Ken lived through the war as a teenager and a young adult. I was growing up. Jeff Ward was already married and had children and was very much engaged with following what was going on in the news. But it turns out that as we sort of delved into it more and more deeply, we realized as filmmakers and storytellers and amateur historians, we didn't know that much about it. And one of the reasons why is that it's impossible when you're in the middle of it to know. So, you know, we couldn't know what was going on in the front lines in the jungles in Vietnam. We couldn't know what was going on inside the Pentagon and the White House or in the Politburo or in the Presidential Palace in Saigon. And there's just a lot of new scholarship and new information that we now have access to that people didn't know at the time. So we believe pretty firmly that Americans in general don't know much about this, even those who lived through it.
Mm-hmm.
Many veterans said to us, look, you know, I was in the war, but I don't know anything about it because I was just in my little part and
right.
I know what happened to me. So, and someone who was at home, they don't know what their brother was going through in Vietnam and vice versa. So what we've done is really sort of pulled the camera way back to take in all of it and then also allow you to sort of zero in deeply into intimate moments in all the places that I said. And in putting it all together, it's like a big puzzle and there were a lot of pieces missing. And I think we've filled in a lot of the blanks.
You know,
we'll see.
One of the searing controversies about this war that hasn't gone away is the extent to which the Kennedy administration was responsible for starting it. Where do you come down on that now that you've finished this project?
Well, I will say to start that we do not engage in our film in the debate about what would have happened if Kennedy had not been killed and whether the war would have gone the way it went. That, we felt, was a diversion from the story of what actually happened. And there's no way to know for sure whether Kennedy would or wouldn't have escalated the war. But certainly he bears a lot of responsibility for getting us involved in a deep way. However, we trace the origins of America's involvement in Vietnam back to World War II. So our connection to that place and our interest in what happened there really began in earnest as the Second World War was ending and the Cold War was beginning. And Truman and Eisenhower both got us connected to and involved in the struggle that the French were having to try to preserve their colony. And we supported the French war, and we paid for most of it. And then when it ended, we basically took it over. And that's where Kennedy essentially picked up the reins and sort of decided or made the decision that it was important for America to try to stop communism from taking over. And that's got us on a path that ended in 1975.
You know, according to the website on the film, Linda, the plan is to have an unprecedented outreach and public engagement program providing opportunities for communities to participate in a national conversation about what happened during the Vietnam War, what went wrong, and what lessons are to be learned. And I'm wondering, how's that process been going?
It's been really exciting. You know, I think we would say there's two phases to that, because the first phase is right now. Ken and I and some of our colleagues have been traveling around the country, and I've just been to Vietnam as well, to show some highlights in the film and to sort of raise awareness that it's coming and to suggest that we think it would be great for the country to have this conversation you just described. And so we've been screening the film and talking about it and having conversations with veterans, with people who protested the war, with families that were divided, with people who went to jail to register their objection to it, you know, a whole range of people. With children of people who were killed in the war who don't know what happened. They're still trying to figure it out. So it's been a wonderful and provocative and painful conversation that we've seen already starting to bubble up. And also among Vietnamese Americans, who many of whom their parents came here as refugees and also don't talk much about what happened before they came here. So there's a tremendous interest in making sense of their own family's experiences. That said, we are looking forward to what's going to happen this fall when the film is actually on air and online and our country can see it and then have, a much deeper conversation. And we're looking, I think, at PBS stations and libraries and veterans groups and other organizations are planning conversations in person, what we call in real life, and then there's also going to be a lot of virtual conversations as well. And I think it's provocative and it's painful and it's traumatic and it's also sort of cathartic to get it out there. You know, I was just in Vietnam, and one of the writers that we showed some of the episodes of the film to said, you know, in Vietnam we have a saying that we flaunt the good things and we hide the bad things and put them in a drawer and shut it and try to forget they ever happened. And I thought, that's not just in Vietnam, that we've sort of tried to shove Vietnam into a closet and just want it to go away. And it just isn't going to happen. It's still here. It's still kind of haunting us. We're still, in a way, arguing about it without really understanding what happened. And we hope our film gives our country a chance to really excavate that experience in a deep way. And we're sure there will be some tough conversations.
Right.
But ultimately, we've seen in the screenings that we've had a willingness for people who maybe don't ordinarily listen to each other to listen and to hear each other and then to speak.
I want to bring in Cliff Keel. He's the CEO for Kansas City Public Television. KCPT presents the Vietnam War, An Evening with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick on Sunday, September 8th from 7 to 9 in the evening at the Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland. There's still tickets available at kcpt.org. Cliff, what's going to take place there?
That will be the conversation with Ken and Lynn, and then Dr. Will Banks and John Musgrave also will be there. And so we're really excited and honored to have Ken and Lynn come here. And we're doing a lot of things around this. You know, we feel a tremendous sense of sort of honor, but also a little pressure to make sure we fully leverage this amazing documentary. The little bit I've seen of it so far, it's so powerful. And so we are doing some local storytelling at KCPT on September 29th. We'll have a documentary that will air then. We're going to have
a local documentary.
With veteran stories. We're going to have Radio America DJs and some veterans on The Bridge, our radio station, with some special content on October 19th. And kind of keeping the conversation going, referring back to sort of what Lynn was talking about. And so we've had a story booth that's been out gathering veteran stories, and then people can still go in online at kcpt.org and share those stories. So really trying to just help people, you know, with their families and veterans, you know, find that context and sort of figure out sort of what this war meant. So we're honored to do our little part here, but we feel like, you know, really honored to work with Ken and Lynn, and certainly they're only going, I think, to eight cities, and so we're very lucky to have them come here to Kansas City.
Along those lines, I was going to say, what is the role of local PBS stations with an epic series like the Vietnam War, Cliff?
Well, I mean, I think I touched on that. That's
you want to bring it home.
Yeah, we're really trying to help people through engagement events, through the story booth, through the online story sharing, a timeline where people can go in and kind of find where they fit in on the timeline.
Do people still want to wrestle with this war? Is that the sense you get?
You know, we were at our celebration at the station event, and I saw veterans going there with their family members, and we had a map out, and we had a little booth there, and they were going and sort of marking where they served and kind of showing their families on the map. So to me, which really struck me is just, you know, they might not have done that before to go show their family, you know, that's where I was. And so, you know, if we can do a little bit to localize this and take the power of the documentary and then create, you know, help people understand this or explain it or have a conversation with their families, you know, we feel like that's good work for us to try to do at the local level.
You know, Lynn Novick, I understand you took the film over to Vietnam and screened it there. Who saw the film? And I'm curious, how was it received?
Extremely well received. And I just, before I answer that, I just want to jump quickly on to what the local station is doing, which is tremendously exciting. One of the things we think is also a great opportunity is for intergenerational conversations between Vietnam veterans and veterans of current wars and soldiers who are still active duty in our current wars. And John Musgrave, who's going to be joining us, along with James Wilbanks, who's a professor at the Army General Command College, John Musgrave works with Vietnam veterans and active duty military and veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq to share their experiences about what it's like to come home and how to cope with reintegration and adjusting to civilian life and carrying the memories of war with you. And I'm sure that will be part of our conversation when we're in Kansas City, but I think it's also a great opportunity the film affords for some interesting and important ways for people within the military community to connect, and also to connect across the civilian-military divide, because that's a huge problem in our society. And there's an opportunity for people who didn't serve but who know people who did or who opposed the war and maybe have had conflict about that with veterans to try to have a different kind of conversation about it. And I think all those things are going to happen, and it's very exciting.
So just quickly, Lynn, how was the film received in Vietnam?
It was really an amazing experience because we showed it to the people who were in it. We have had the whole film subtitled in Vietnamese so they can watch it. And it's going to be streamed on the PBS website, pbs.org/thevietnamwar, when it airs here. And it will be available to be streamed in Vietnam as well. And Vietnam has tremendous internet access, and the internet is not controlled by any entity. So and like half the country has internet access, and we expect that millions of people in Vietnam will watch it when it's online. And they are very interested, the veterans that were in the film and the civilians who gave us their testimony, as well as young people, writers, editors, historians, filmmakers. We showed it to a variety of people, clips and some episodes. And what we heard over and over again was that they really appreciated the honesty, the realism, the authenticity, the testimony of ordinary
right.
people, and not what they saw at big shots, because we consciously chose not to include interviews with the most famous sort of Vietnam personalities of our American narrative. They're in the film archivally, but not interviewed today, and that would be Jane Fonda, Daniel Ellsberg, Henry Kissinger, John McCain, and John Kerry, people like that. They're in the film, but not giving their testimony today, and the Vietnamese really appreciated that. They felt that that gave a layer of kind of honesty and directness to the story. And, you know, I think they just welcomed the possibility that this film will help Americans and Vietnamese to understand themselves
right.
and each other better. Someone said it's ironic that the war divided our countries, but this film about the war may bring our countries closer together.
Lynn Novick is a principal with Ken Burns Media. She's the co-director and co-producer of the Vietnam War. Lynn, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to coming to Kansas City.
Cliff Keel is the CEO of KCPT. Cliff, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
KCPT presents the Vietnam War, an evening with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick on Sunday, September 8th from 7 to 9 in the evening at the Midland. For more information, go to midlandkc.com. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about music and sex and a new book, Good Booty. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we did our best to help parents with infants encourage good sleep habits with their babies. You can find that conversation online at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, is it just me or are there a lot of films coming out after the summer blockbusters? I'll ask our critics as they review all the independent foreign and documentary films playing at area theaters. Well, NPR music critic Ann Powers is out with a new book that dissects the role that sex, gender, and race played in creating popular music in America. The book, Good Booty, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music, argues that music and each of those themes are intrinsically linked. And if you think this journey of sexuality and music began with Elvis, think again. Ann Powers is NPR's music critic and correspondent and is the former chief pop music critic at the LA Times. She co-wrote Tori Amos' Piece by Piece with the singer, and she joins us this morning from Nashville Public Radio. Ann, good to have you. Good morning.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So Elvis didn't begin this journey of music and sexuality and wiggling hips. Say it's not so.
Well, I think most people probably do know that, of course, at least stretching back to the dirty blues of the 1920s, Americans have been using music to talk about every aspect of their sexuality and erotic life. And in my book, I actually go all the way back to the beginning of the 19th century,
yes,
looking at New Orleans and how dancing and songs that are rarely performed today took up the same subject matter even then.
You say an interesting thing in here. If Elvis was the king of rock and roll, Little Richard was Christopher Columbus. How so?
Well, Little Richard is a... Well, first of all, I have to thank him for giving me the title of my book, but maybe we can get into that in a minute. But Little Richard, you know, he is a transitional figure in some ways. He was a performer in clubs throughout the South, just at that moment when R&B was turning into rock and roll. And he brought this level of excitement and joyful dirtiness, I guess we'll call it, into the music. And I think he invented rock and roll attitude in a way that even Elvis did not. He's really our quintessential rock star.
Let's remind our listeners just what Little Richard sounded like. Here's Little Richard singing Tutti Frutti.
Wah, bah, 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 tutti frutti. Oh,
I think that gives you a pretty good idea, Ann, right there.
Yes, definitely. It's interesting, that song, because that's where the phrase Good Booty, the title of my book, comes from.
That's right.
A dirtier version that people were performing in clubs in the South, that when Little Richard recorded it, he and his co-writer, Dorothy Labastri, transformed into evocative nonsense. When we think about music from the early 50s and mid-50s, there's so much nonsense in it, you know, doo-wop especially, which I also write about. This was a time when young people were trying to say things they were not supposed to be saying in public, and they were doing it through music. And that's what rock and roll expressed. That's what doo-wop expressed, and I love to go back and just, you know, really immerse in that.
You also cite Buddy Holly as key here, and you write this: if Little Richard had a mirror image, it was Buddy Holly, the young oddball who came on the scene in 1957. Tell us about Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly's so interesting. You know, he was very different in terms of his image than most of the early rock stars who were, you know, they were heartthrobs. Buddy was a nerd, for sure, and it wasn't just the glasses. It's also his vocal approach, his approach to music. It's very studied. His way of singing, you know, you can hear every thought kind of unfurling in his mouth and in his mind. And I think that really mirrors what teenagers were going through at the time, this anxiety they had about how to become adult, which was all about how to be sexual. You know, kids were dating super young in the 50s because it was after World War II, and they were being encouraged to form families very young. And it was scary. It was scary to be a teenager. And that's what Buddy's music captured, as well as the joy.
Here's a little snippet from Buddy Holly. This is Peggy Sue.
Without Peggy, my Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, Gallus. I love you, Peggy Sue.
You know, I've been up to that surf ballroom in Clear Lake, Iowa, and it just breaks your heart even walking in the place, doesn't it?
It's such a hard thing that we lost so many rockers of that era, young or, you know, if we didn't lose them literally, like we lost Buddy Holly in that plane crash. We lost him to other things. Elvis entering the army after he came back, his music was very different. Little Richard struggling with a conflict within himself that led him to, you know, leave rock and roll and enter the ministry at the end of the 50s.
Yeah.
He came back, but, you know, it kind of derailed his career. Jerry Lee Lewis had a scandal when he married his very young cousin. Chuck Berry got thrown in jail. It's one of the strange and tragic stories of early rock and roll.
You said you go so far back in this book, obviously long before Elvis. You talk about the Methodists in the early 1800s arguing about how much they should move their bodies when playing church music. Frame that argument for us.
In the very beginning of our country, from the very beginning of our country, we were a nation of disparate cultural groups, different experiences, and also racially diverse. Racially diverse because of a horrible legacy, of course, slavery, as well as from immigration, you know, and different groups coming to America. And white and African European and African worshipers really approached things differently, you know, and African dance, it kind of made its way into everything. But many people were sort of afraid of the fact that people moved in their religious ceremonies. They moved and danced. That dance, incidentally, is connected to what we see Beyonce doing in the videos for Lemonade. So it's a tradition that runs throughout our entire history.
We're visiting with NPR music critic Ann Powers about her new book, Good Booty, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music. Did you know heading into this project, Ann, that you would wind up going back as far as you did in the history books?
I did not. I thought I was going to start at the beginning of the 20th century and really open with the jazz age, which is just an undisputable moment of excitement about the body, you know. And people at that time in the teens and 20s, sexology was happening. People were wondering if they could make their marriages spicier. That was reflected in dance styles from the tango to the shimmy. And I loved that. But I was living in the South in Alabama when I started this project and going to New Orleans a lot. And I thought, I have got to talk about New Orleans. I have to talk about how that place is the seedbed of American culture, and that what it bore, what that seedbed bore, is mixing multiculturalism, you know, people coming together, rubbing up against each other, sometimes also always, you know, through oppression, through violence. It wasn't just a sunny, rosy thing, but I needed to get into that history to set up what came in the 20th century.
I was going to say, is it fair to say that your own experiences growing up with the music is what led ultimately to this book?
Well, I've been writing about music since I was a teenager, and I'm now in my 50s, so certainly had quite a long time to ponder this stuff and experience it. And yeah, I would say definitely, even as a teen, I was always curious about why music affected me physically as well as emotionally. Mm-hmm. And it definitely was my lens into eroticism and sexuality. It's definitely how I had my education in those matters. So I thought, well, let's look at that historically.
You know, you mentioned that we struggle in this country still today when it comes to talking frankly about sex and race. And you wonder sometimes where we'd be without music. I'm wondering, where do you think we would be?
It's so hard and impossible, really, to imagine. Sure. Music is a fundamental. It's part of every culture, and it seems to, as much, you know, as far as we know, go back all the way to prehistoric times. But I think music is what connects us most powerfully across cultural lines, and that's something that, you know, we continue to turn to, including in moments of crisis. As I said before, you know, that can be problematic. People appropriating other cultures. I know there's a lot of concern about that. But I believe, I am an optimist. I believe that in the moment when people are sharing music and exchanging music and dancing together, that we are our best selves. And we can be our best selves. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, to celebrate that.
You know, you talk about something else in here, this very interesting concept of somebody-ness that Martin Yes. Luther King Jr. once talked about. What is somebody-ness, and how does music help build it?
Somebody-ness is the inherent understanding and experience of dignity and self-respect and Mm-hmm. Self-possession. And Martin Luther King used the phrase to remind people in the civil rights struggle and African Americans who were fighting with him for civil rights, that even at during the most, you know, horrific oppression and violence, you have yourself within yourself. And what preserves and feeds somebody-ness? Music has always been a major source of sustenance for that part of ourselves. Yeah. We saw it in the civil rights movement. Music was key, you know, people singing in the streets
Yes.
in Selma and on the radio, Aretha Franklin, you know, soul music. So that is something that I trace throughout this entire history. And I think it's connected to the erotic. Audre Lorde said, you know, the erotic is power. It is the power to believe in yourself and connect with others. And that's what I'm trying to talk about.
You know, you cite a series of pioneers who pushed this envelope of taking music into places that had once been so taboo. Can you cite three or four of these pioneers for us? And would Elvis be one of them?
Elvis is definitely one. I'm a major Elvis fan, and I do think that when you're thinking about the mid-century of American music, you have to talk about Elvis. And he really was he was the force that carried it throughout the country. He's everywhere in the media in the 1950s, you know, in magazines, on television, just everybody's talking about Elvis. So yes, but I'm also interested in completely unsung or forgotten figures like Florence Mills, who was a Yes. huge star in the 1920s in New York, a theater performer, a singer, a dancer, an advocate for the NAACP, and really the embodiment of the new woman, the new way of being a woman in the 20s. She died young and never recorded anything, so we have forgotten her. Dorothy Love Coates, who is one of the greatest gospel singers out of Birmingham, Alabama, you know, inspired Little Richard. Those whoops that we hear from Little Richard are partly from Dorothy Love Coates. So she's another one, and there's so many more.
It's just amazing to me as I get older, sort of listening to the progression of music and how acts 20 years ago directly influence what we're hearing today. Music is such a shared commodity as it gets handed down from year to year and generation to generation.
It is. And, you know, right now we're living in a funny moment where we're always talking on social media to each other and taking sides, and people are mad at Taylor Swift, or they're mad at, you know, Katy Perry or Nicki Minaj. Nobody ever gets mad at Beyonce because she's the queen, so you can't get mad at her. But all of that is just like, I'm not saying that we shouldn't talk about what messages these stars are putting out in the world, but to me it's all extraneous to the music, you know, and to what the music makes us feel and how it can inspire us. And I always want to go back to that. I'm interested in the pop star machine and the persona and all of that. But I want us to remember that music is essentially something that can unite us and, you know, to always connect with it. Share music with your friends and family. That's the best thing you can do.
Now, this surprised me. One group that you cite for their sexiness quotient is the Grateful Dead, Anne. That wouldn't be the first band that would come to mind when it comes to raw sex appeal. Why the Grateful Dead?
Probably more cooked sex appeal, I guess. The Grateful Dead in San Francisco were very important because, you know, they were kind of the house band of the Summer of Love. That moment in the late 1960s when the counterculture, the hippie culture, was exploring new ways of being free in everything, including sexuality. And the reason the Dead are important is precisely because they weren't sex symbols. You know, you had the Beatles, you had the Stones, you had these performers that people watched, you know, and all the energy was channeled toward them in a way. And then you had the Dead, who didn't even consider themselves separate from their audience. And so at their shows, people would just dance free form. And I mean, there were substances being ingested. Yeah. So crazy stuff happened. And that feeling of freedom that they offered to their fans allowed for a lot of sexual and all kinds of experimentation, really.
Here's the Grateful Dead playing Touch of Grey. You know, outside of the pioneers, which performers, in your view, Anne, are most adept at expressing their sexuality, their outrage yet cruel circumstance? Are there performers who just stand out to you over the years?
Well, number one has to be Prince.
Yeah.
You know, Prince, for me, was, you know, I mean, really was my favorite rock star of all time, star of everything. But you know, he offered a vision of sexuality that was so fluid and so much of a, you know, so utopian in a sense. I'm also a huge Madonna fan. I know that in some ways it's not cool to be into Madonna, but I was just listening to Like a Prayer again, her great album from the 80s, and thinking about how beautifully she embodied the conflicts that a lot of women feel, especially, you know, being raised Catholic. She deals with a lot of that, shame issues, and really gets into a place of joy and where we need to express ourselves. I recommend listening to Madonna's Express Yourself three times in a row. It's a good tonic. It's sort of like doing a juice cleanse or something.
Hey, just quickly before you go, who are you watching on the music scene right now? Who's catching your attention for NPR's Music Critic?
Well, Annie Clark, who performs under the name St. Vincent, is one of my favorite current stars, and she has a new album coming out really soon. She's just super adept at writing songs that address every part of the human experience. She's very intellectual, but she also is very feelingful, and she's just a total bad mother on the guitar. So that's my recommendation for this season right now is St. Vincent.
NPR music critic Anne Powers is the author of the book with the unforgettable title, A Good Booty, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music. Anne, what a pleasure. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Well, look who's here to talk about some cool stuff to do on this upcoming long, leisurely three-day weekend. Brian McTavish, how are you?
I am so
welcome back.
Happy to get in on this thing. Yeah.
Little Aaron Copland to kick things off.
Well, is there such thing as a little Aaron Copland?
No,
even a little is a lot.
That's right.
You know, it evokes the pioneer spirit, right?
That's what he did so well.
That's what he did so well. And you know who else celebrates that is Santa Caligon Days.
Yeah, a tradition around these parts.
Oh, would you believe it's the 45th annual?
Is that right?
Yeah,
Good for them.
It, of course, is the festival commemorating our country's 19th century westward expansion. It gets going Thursday evening on the historic.
That's tonight.
Yes, I'm
right
sorry.
Now.
That's right. You're
just
always in the hours moment.
Hours away.
Hours away from the carnival only. That's from 5 to 10. And that's get started tonight on historic Independence Square in Independence. And then it's, you know, noon to 11 Friday, 10 to 11 Saturday and Sunday. And if you still have a hankering for a corn dog or
a funnel cake.
Yes, go west, young man. Go with a funnel cake. You can also come back from 10 to 5 on Monday. They have lots of bands on stage. They have 400 or so arts, crafts, and food booths. But I'm looking forward to the Little Mr. and Miss Independence Contest, where you get the wee ones, the little tykes, and they're dressed up to the nines. And mom and dad and the grandparents and the aunt and the uncle and who knows are all, so cute.
Yeah.
And you know, if they win.
What do they get?
They get, which would you take? A $50.
A convertible.
Yes, well, moving on. No,
yeah.
They're offering a $50 savings deposit at some local independence bank or a $50 gift certificate.
Okay.
Which would you rather have? Like
the gift certificate.
Of course you would. Oh,
yeah.
Also, there's the whiskers contest.
Oh.
And if you're the best at having the craziest beard, you get a grooming kit, which seems sort of the opposite of what you'd want if you were whiskery. But anyway, check out all the fun, Santa Caligon, all weekend long.
That's a theme song to the Munsters, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Good ear.
Yes.
Good ear.
Yes. Good ear.
Okay.
Good notes.
Herman Munster, among other intriguing things, liked to get behind the wheel of more than one or two hot rods.
That's right.
Right. There was the family coach.
Made
out of coffin parts or something. And then there was the, there were a wide assortment of crazy wheels that he would get behind the wheel of. And it's pertinent because it's time for Greaserama.
Mm.
Greaserama is the Midwest's original punk rock car show, right?
Wow.
Featuring crazy, monstrous bands and even crazier, more monstrous custom car culture. It's from noon to midnight Saturday. It's from noon to 5 Sunday. It takes place on the Platte County Fairgrounds in Platte City.
All right.
Basically, it goes back to the marriage of monsters and hot rod culture back to the 1960s when images and designs that evoked the weird and the cool, things were so ugly they were pretty.
Mm.
And it all comes down to me, to Ed Big Daddy Roth. It all came together with this guy because he was a designer of insane-looking custom cars and even crazier, totally subversive dragster tunes like Rat Fink.
Okay.
So that's where all this springs from. Have a great weirdo time. And I mean that at Greaserama.
Check out Brian Six, True Believer Things to Do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
But it's a great place for old ladies, the hairdressers. You know what, old ladies, when they get to a certain age and they don't go for a natural color anymore, do you know what I mean? They see a car on the way to the hairdressers. And they come in like, I want two-tone blue. I want to look like a Hyundai accent. And they get these mad two-tone blue hair, like mental looking, you know. And then they go home and they do something to their faces that only clowns and old women do, right? They shave off their eyebrows. They get a pencil and they draw a pair of eyebrows. But up here on the tops of their foreheads. So they just look really surprised all the time. They're like that. Is that the bus? Is it?
Who do we have there?
Oh, boy. Okay.
Man. Well,
that guy sounds a little Irish to me.
Yes,
How about you?
Okay, a little bit Irish.
That is veteran standout stand-up comic Joe Rooney. Joe Rooney, right. And he, I don't know, after hearing that little bit of comedy, I don't know whether I feel sorrier for clowns or old ladies. I guess the clowns ultimately. Clowns always would probably win in that
but
contest.
But he's part of something
yes,
bigger.
Yes, he's, well, Joe might think he's the star of the show, but he is one of the stars of the Kansas City Irish Festival. He's one of several stand-up comics of Irish descent who will be making you laugh. Is that made us chuckle just a bit. Of course, the Kansas City Irish Festival is the yearly celebration of Irish heritage with lots of live music, aforementioned comedy. Actually, Joe has two shows Saturday, 2 and 8, and two shows Sunday at 2 and 8, and the early matinees are on the children's stage.
Oh,
so wow. I think he will avoid naughtiness.
That would be the idea.
Yes, that would be the idea. 30 bands, 7 stages, a giant children's area, and a chance to investigate your Irish genealogy if you think you have one, all weekend long at KC Irish Fest.
Pretty. Who do we have there?
Okay, that is pretty, isn't it?
Is pretty.
I'm going to slaughter her name because I don't know how to say it. Perhaps you do. Would you like to take a stab at it?
No, it's all yours.
So I'll go down with the ship. Okay, it's, I believe, Shreya Ghoshal. G-H-O-S-H-A-L. Anyway,
right.
She is from India,
mm.
And she is a playback singer. She is known as the Melody Queen of Bollywood. Do you know what a playback singer is?
I do not.
Okay, when you're on the set of a movie musical, a traditional movie musical, and all the actors and actresses are there and they're ready to lip sync. Well, in this country, in America, typically they're lip syncing their own vocals. They've just pre-recorded them. Well, in India, for the most part, if not entirely, every actor and actress you see in an over-the-top spectacular Indian musical is not responsible for those vocals. So when the director yells on the set, playback, you hear people like Shreya Ghoshal singing, who's made a career out of just being a playback singer.
You can see her at 8 p.m. Sunday at Music Hall.
She's the star of the show, 8 o'clock Sunday at the Music Hall, the Melody Queen of Bollywood. Don't miss it.
I'm trying to tell you something about my life. Maybe give me insight between black and white. And the best thing you ever done.
I've always liked these guys, the Indigo Girls.
They are so great.
So terrific.
Okay, they came out, they broke out in 1989 with this tune, Closer to Fine. And ever since, this folk rocking duo, we're talking about Emily Saliers, I'm probably saying that wrong too, but I love her voice, and Amy Ray,
right.
They have been a beacon of personal expression, musical integrity, and honest to goodness emotional truth. I mean, they are just so satisfying. Go check them out Saturday, 8 o'clock. Crossroads KC, Better Than Ever, Indigo Girls.
That'd be a good way to spend some time. That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
You have a great Labor Day weekend.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, the film critics will be here. Lots of new films to talk about coming out for the long Labor Day weekend. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. Closer I am to-